Historical What Ifs. Historical What Ifs.
History hinges on moments so small they could fit in the palm of your hand, yet their consequences echo through centuries and shape the world we live in today. This is Historical What Ifs, where we explore the alternate timelines that could have emerged from a single different decision, a missed opportunity, or a stroke of luck that went the other way. Today's episode examines one of those pivotal moments and traces the extraordinary chain of events that might have followed if history had taken just one small turn in a different direction. Welcome to Historical What Ifs, reimagining pivotal moments.
When you picture the Industrial Revolution, what's the first image that comes to mind?
For me, it's visceral. It's the hiss of a steam engine, the clang of a steel mill, and above all, the thick gray smoke pouring from 1,000 brick chimneys. It's the look, the sound, and the smell of coal.
Exactly. Coal is the ghost in the machine of that entire era. It's so fundamental to our understanding of that period, of how we got to now, that it feels almost immovable, inevitable.
But what if it wasn't? What if that black combustible rock, the very fuel of progress, was never discovered? What if humanity stood on the cusp of modernity without the cheap, abundant energy source that made it all possible?
That question, it's one that has always fascinated me from a purely inventive standpoint. I'm drawn to the stories of Watt, of Stephenson, of the brilliant minds who harnessed this power. To think of them having to solve the same problems, how to pump water, how to power a loom, how to cross a continent, without their primary tool, that's a puzzle I can't resist.
And I'm captivated by the social script. The great migration to the cities, the birth of the factory system, the complete reordering of society, all of it was supercharged by coal. Take it away, and what happens to that story? Does that unseen revolution still happen, or does the world stay agrarian for another century?
Would we have turned to wind, or water, or something else entirely? Or would the gears of progress have ground to a halt? That is the incredible alternate timeline we are going to build today.
So let's start right there. The gears of progress. Before steam, the primary mover wasn't a chemical reaction locked in a rock. It was gravity. It was water turning a wheel. And we had gotten very good at it.
Extremely good. But that immediately introduces the single biggest constraint, doesn't it? Geography. You can't build a water-powered mill in the middle of a flat field. You have to go to the power. The power doesn't come to you.
And that changes everything. The historical Industrial Revolution, the one powered by coal, meant you could build a factory anywhere you could transport the fuel. You could build it in Manchester, in London, right in the heart of a city.
Right. But in a water-powered world, your industrial centers aren't cities in the way we think of them. They're long, thin ribbons of development, stretched out along the banks of fast-flowing rivers. Think of the early mills in New England, or the valleys of Derbyshire.
So the great, sprawling, smog-choked metropolis. Maybe that doesn't happen, or at least not in the same way. You don't get a cottonopolis like Manchester, a single dense hub of production.
Instead, you get, what? A dozen smaller competing mill towns along the River Irwell, each one jealously guarding its water rights? That creates a totally different political and economic landscape. It's decentralized by necessity.
But what about the scale? A water wheel, even a massive one, can only generate so much power. It can run one mill, maybe a couple of workshops. The Savory and Newcomen engines, even before Watt perfected them, were used for a singular, massive task. Pumping water out of mines. Without coal, you never get that. That leap to the high-pressure steam engine that could power an entire factory, a locomotive, a ship.
Ah, but are we underestimating human ingenuity? If all the brain power that Watt and Stephenson put into steam had been poured into hydraulics, what would they have come up with? Would we have seen the development of massive, sophisticated water turbines a century early? Could they have developed hydraulic accumulator systems to store and transmit power using high-pressure water in pipes?
That's a fascinating thought. Transmitting power through pipes, so you could have a giant water wheel on the river and then run pipes from it to power machines half a mile away.
Why not? It's a different technological path, but it's not impossible. It's just localized. You're still tethered to the river valley. You can't run a water pipe from Manchester to London, so the problem of transport becomes even more critical.
Which puts immense pressure on the other existing technologies, canals. The Bridgewater Canal was a marvel. It halved the price of coal in Manchester. But in this timeline, it's not transporting coal, it's transporting raw materials to the river valleys and finished goods out.
And canals are slow. They freeze in the winter. They can't cross mountains easily. So without coal, you're not just missing the engine for the factory. You're missing the engine for the railway. You're stuck at the speed of a horse pulling a barge. Does a true interconnected national economy ever form?
That is the billion-dollar question, isn't it? I mean, a truly national market relies on speed and volume. It relies on the ability to move massive quantities of goods from anywhere to anywhere, predictably. Canals, they just don't cut it. So you end up with these incredibly productive, but also incredibly isolated, economic islands.
And the people who own those islands, the ones who own the riverbanks with the steepest drop, they become the new aristocracy. It's not the person who owns a coal mine, it's the person who owns a waterfall. Power becomes even more tied to land and inheritance than it already was.
Oh, that's a chilling thought. It's almost a step backwards, isn't it? A kind of techno-feudalism. You don't have the social mobility that, in theory, came with the new industrial cities. You can't just move to Manchester and get a job in a factory, because the factory is a string of workshops 50 miles long, all controlled by the local landed gentry.
And think about the politics of that. In our timeline, we saw the rise of mass political movements like the Chartists, born in the densely packed, miserable conditions of those new cities. Millions of people sharing a common grievance. But if your workforce is scattered across dozens of small competing mill towns, how do you organize them?
It would be profoundly difficult. A general strike, like the one in 1842, becomes almost logistically impossible. You can't just stop production across Britain. You'd have to coordinate action along hundreds of miles of separate river valleys, each with its own river baron, for lack of a better term.
The river baron? I like that. And he wouldn't just control your wages. He controls the water. He literally controls the power that runs the loom that you operate, the mill that grinds your flour, everything. That's a level of absolute tangible control that even a Victorian factory owner couldn't dream of.
So, the nature of protest might change. Maybe it's less about forming unions and more direct, more like the Luddites. It's not about political reform on a national scale, but about smashing the sluice gate at the upstream mill because they're hoarding water and your town is starving.
Yes, the conflicts become parochial. They're not class-based in a national sense. They're town versus town, valley versus valley. The big political fight in Parliament isn't about free trade or extending the franchise. It's about the Upper Derwent Water Rights Act of 1840. It's smaller, more fractious.
And what about the rest of the world? Britain's industrial might, its empire, was built on its ability to mass-produce textiles and steel and ship them anywhere. That's what destroyed, for instance, the hand loom industry in India. But if Britain's production is capped by the number of fast-flowing rivers it has, does it ever achieve that level of global dominance?
It feels unlikely. Its advantage is less pronounced. Other places have rivers. France has the Rhone. The German states have the Rhine. The United States has, well, it has vast, powerful river systems. Maybe the Industrial Revolution isn't a uniquely British event in this timeline. Maybe it happens in 5 or 6 places at once, in a much more limited, water-bound way.
And that, for me, is the most profound takeaway from this whole exercise. The idea of a multipolar industrialization, it completely rewrites the script for the 19th century. Britain's global dominance wasn't just about technology, it was about having a 50-year head start with an almost limitless energy source. Take that away, and you don't get the British Empire as we knew it.
You just don't. You get a world of intense but balanced regional competition. The Ruhr Valley in Germany, her river systems in the northeastern United States, maybe parts of France, they all industrialize at a similar, slower pace. There's no single nation capable of projecting that kind of power across the entire globe.
So the great colonial scramble, the race for resources that defined the late 1800s, maybe it never reaches that fever pitch. The conflicts remain smaller, more contained. More like those valley versus valley disputes we imagined.
It's almost a less dramatic world, which is a strange thing to say. But it seems like so many of the seismic shifts of our timeline came from the sheer concentration that coal allowed. A concentration of capital, of labor, of pollution, of social grievance.
That's it. Density. That's the word. Coal created a density of everything. Our water-powered world is by its very nature diffuse, spread out. And I think that's the core insight here. Progress and all its consequences would have been spread thinner over a much longer period.
But, and this is the thought that's been nagging at me, are we underestimating the power of the idea? The scientific revolution, the Enlightenment, that cat was already out of the bag. The mindset of experimentation, of improving efficiency, that was already there. If all those brilliant minds couldn't use coal, would they have just given up? Or would the pressure have forced a breakthrough somewhere else?
You mean, like what? Early electricity, harnessing wind power on a massive scale?
Perhaps. Or maybe something we haven't even considered. The point is, human ingenuity was the driving force. Coal was just the most convenient fuel. I can't help but wonder if a coalless world, while slower to start, might have stumbled upon a more sustainable, cleaner technological path out of sheer necessity. Maybe we would have bypassed the worst of the smoke and smog and gone straight to a greener form of power just a century later.
See, that's the optimist in you speaking. It's a lovely thought, a sort of cleaner, gentler modernity. But I'm not so sure. I keep coming back to the idea of coal as a battering ram. It was brutal, dirty, and destructive, but it was powerful enough to smash the old agrarian structures. Without that overwhelming force, I worry the river barons and the old landed interests would have had enough power to resist change, to keep society locked in that techno-feudal state we talked about. My final thought is a bit darker, that progress wasn't a gentle tide, it was an explosion.
The explosion versus the rising tide. I suppose that's the fundamental question we're left with, isn't it? It's incredible to think that the entire trajectory of the modern world could hinge on whether or not humanity found a particular black rock. It really is a powerful reminder of how fragile and how contingent our own history is. The butterfly effect of history reminds us that the world we know today is just one of countless possibilities, shaped by moments of chance, choice, and consequence that could have easily gone another way. This has been Historical What Ifs, where every episode reveals how fragile our timeline really is, and how different decisions by our ancestors might have created an entirely different present. Understanding these alternate possibilities doesn't just satisfy our curiosity. It helps us appreciate how remarkable it is that we ended up in this particular version of history.